Now, the World Cup is well underway, and we wanted to take a look back on this episode at some of the biggest controversies, not just surrounding this World Cup, but in World Cup history. Let me explain.
Let me explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform it is you consume your podcasts from. This week we are talking about the World Cup. Yes, it is that time every 4 years when even people like me who only kind of have a passing interest in football are suddenly like, yeah, do you know what? I really need to get up at 2 a.m. to watch that pool match that could be so deciding, and start listening to the likes of Tim Vickery go into massive depth on South American football, which I literally only visit once every 4 years. But someone who pays far more attention to these things than I is Cameron Hill of Off the Ball. Cameron, is this, like, I don't even want to describe it, is this like your Christmas for you, or where does this stand in your sporting pantheon?
It's like one of those bad Christmases, you know, where you're not really looking forward to going over to your cousins, and you know that it's going to be quite a difficult day, maybe around the 27th of December, because this time it's really felt like, and there are multiple reasons for this, but there's been such a lead in and such a kind of disappointing lead into the World Cup. Obviously, from an Irish perspective, us not getting there because of the playoff and the penalty shootout defeat to Czechia means that it stings all that more. But it felt like, because of the Trump aspect and anything he touches means that we will have a daily news cycle on anything that he's involved with, the various different scandals, the fact that it's breaking numerous unwanted records this World Cup already heading into the tournament, makes it feel like it's a strange World Cup where I don't even think the football is going to be able to distract it, because usually that's the opiate and it's the veneer, right? Whenever the football gets underway, all we talk about is the football and all the scandals kind of fall by the wayside. Whereas the fact that I think so many of these games are on at weird hours means that not even the football is going to save them this time.
Yeah, because even, I mean, Qatar, obviously all the build-up was basically controversy, and then it just became this amazing final, and that's what people remember. And really, and maybe it's shame on us as journalists, very few people have looked back, or certainly that I've seen have looked back and said, well, what was the legacy here, and all of the various stuff we talked about. You feel, because this is, yeah, it's on at weird times, but there's going to be no escaping this. I mean, Trump is going to say something ridiculous or attend a game that, and something will go mentally wrong. Like, there's just an element of Americanism that only they can do. I feel like in other countries, the officials, they all blend into the background, even though they have their little moments and their, you know, whatever else they have tied into it. Whereas, you know, this one's just, there's going to be no divorcing it from politics.
No, not at all. And I suspect, given where we are in the world and the fact that games will be going on at like 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, we'll be waking up to whatever happened the night before and how that went. And I have a feeling that journalists obviously will give us good dispatches. Fans who are over there, particularly the fact that there are England and Scotland fans going to this year's World Cup, and they will have probably varying accounts of how that all plays out and their own experience of it. That's going to be really important. The use of social media, I think, will be much greater than it would have been definitely in Qatar in 22 and also in Russia in 2018. I feel like it's going to be a very visual World Cup, not just for the football that's on the pitch, but everything that goes on around it. Because from what I've heard so far, and from the stories and the research that we've kind of been looking into as part of this, it already seems like everyone's going to have a pretty wild and almost like bizarre and remarkable story, in a bad way, from a lot of the things that have already happened.
Yeah, I don't think people would have predicted when you had Russia, Qatar, the USA, that we would confidently say that you have three autocratic petrol states in a row hosting the World Cup. But there you go. Let's get into some of that. Maybe we'll start with, because even looking back on this, I think this is one of those moments in history that just gets more ridiculous as it goes on. Gianni Infantino and the Trump Peace Prize right before he invaded two countries.
Yeah, so just everyone's probably seen this man and gotten to know Gianni Infantino in a very big way over the last 4 years or so. He took over as FIFA president from Sepp Blatter in 2016. We all remember old Sepp laughing about Team 33 in Ireland at the 2010 World Cup. And that brought to an end what seemed to be the finality of a really corrupt era for FIFA. Sepp Blatter's gone. Here comes Gianni Infantino, a UEFA man who's promising that the association will be clean, transparent, accountable from here on in. And that seems to be at odds with his later actions. So President Putin presented Infantino with the country's Order of Friendship medal. For those playing at home, that's the same Russia that FIFA have banned and suspended from competitions over the war in Ukraine that Infantino maybe wants to bring back, because really, what difference did it make, is his point. Ahead of the 2022 edition in Qatar, people might have seen this World Cup widely criticised for the death of migrant workers during the construction of stadia, the state's outlawing of homosexuality, the state's approach to women and women's rights. And Infantino delivers this really extraordinary monologue at a press conference saying, well, today I feel Qatari, I feel Arab, I feel African, I feel gay, I feel disabled, I feel a migrant worker. And was shocked by how badly that was taken and didn't understand why people were so against him on this. He thought he'd get far more support. And there were various other bits in that. Apparently he had to be shown at every game, being in attendance at every game at that World Cup by the host broadcaster, couldn't be shown on his phone. So he's very image conscious. And when Trump returned to the White House in January 2025, Infantino seized the moment. He became really cozy with the American premier, started during last year's World Cup in the USA, the Club World Cup. Chelsea won that edition, but Trump told The Zone after the tournament last summer that he got to keep the Club World Cup trophy, the actual World Cup trophy, and that one was specifically made. Now, FIFA denied this and say that there's actually three versions, one of which is in Trump's Oval Office, one of which Chelsea kept, and one of which is in their headquarters in Zurich, Switzerland. But last autumn, this is when it really gets interesting, Infantino called for Trump to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And when that failed to materialize, he decided that FIFA should take things into their own hands.
Mr. President, this is your prize, this is your peace prize. There is also a beautiful medal for you that you can wear everywhere you want to go.
I'm gonna wear it right now.
Okay.
This is truly one of the great honors of my life. And beyond awards, Johnny and I were discussing this, we saved millions and millions of lives. I want to thank, by the way, my family, my great First Lady, Melania, you're right here, and thank you very much. And I think you're going to have an event the likes of which maybe the world has never seen. Based on the enthusiasm that I've seen, I have never seen anything like it. We've had a tremendous relationship, working relationship with Canada. We have our Prime Minister of Canada there, and we have our President of Mexico. And we've worked closely with those two countries, and the coordination and friendship and relationship has been outstanding. And I want to thank you both very much, and your countries very much. The world is a safer place now. The United States 1 year ago was not doing too well. And now I have to say we're the hottest country anywhere in the world, and we're going to keep it that way. Thank you all. Thank you. Have a great time. And Johnny, a tremendous honor. Thank you.
So that's Gianni Infantino and Donald Trump there, and the FIFA Peace Prize, of course, the one that he really wanted, along with the Nobel, which he seems to have been re-gifted. Strange. Anyway, in all of this, then, where does Iran fit into things? The Iranian team, the sort of political reaction. Also, I remember the last time we were talking about this, we were talking about some teams and indeed some fans being denied entry to the US. Like, how has all that played out?
Well, just to give people background, so Iran have qualified for Group G. They were one of the first nations to actually qualify for this World Cup. I think Japan might have just beaten them to the punch, but Iran were pretty close last year. So they've been drawn to play Belgium, New Zealand and Egypt in Group G. Those games are going to take place in Los Angeles and Seattle. But there has been growing uncertainty over Iran's participation due to the war being waged on the country by the United States, the tournament co-hosts, and Israel. Now, Infantino has been at the center of all this and trying to smooth things over. He posted an Instagram on March in that he had met with Trump and said President Trump has reiterated that the Iranian team is, of course, welcome to compete in the tournament in the United States. A day later, Sean, Trump posted on Truth Social saying that while the Iran national team were welcome at the World Cup, I really don't believe it's appropriate that they be there for their own life and safety, which is a threat under the thinnest veils, I think you can probably agree. They had a FIFA Congress, the FIFA sort of general Congress of all the different member associations in Vancouver back in April. Iran was the only country not present because the Iranian news agency Tasnim had reported that the delegation were turned back at border control in Canada and cited their treatment by Canadian immigration authorities as the reason for them going home. This obviously leads to renewed concerns about whether they'd be able to participate without any obstacles at this World Cup. They met at the end of last month with FIFA to get assurances that they could compete unimpeded. And then they had to move their training base from Tucson in Arizona to Tijuana in Mexico after approval by FIFA, and Mexican Premier Claudia Sheinbaum welcomed them with open arms. Their US visas were only approved on Friday. Visas have been denied for several members of staff, including the head of their football federation, Mehdi Taj. And the football team represents Iran, but is often at odds with the ruling Islamic theocracy, which is interesting because usually wearing a country flag and the way international sport works, you represent all, you take all the baggage that that country brings. But Babak Fizuni, who's a tutor at the Open University, joined Off the Ball a couple of months ago and explained that actually football has a place in Iran that is often in protest with the ruling regime.
I would say that I agree with Bill Shankly here when he said that some people believe football is a matter of life and death. I can assure you it is much, much more important than that. And in Iran, it literally is a matter of life and death. And people give their lives to be able to watch a game of football. Let me just give you one example that ties in with Iranian feminism. There was a case of the Blue Girl. I don't know if you have heard of her. She was known as the Blue Girl. Her first name was Sahar. She was a follower of a team that wore blue, and she tried to get into a football match. This is in 2019, and she dressed as a man in order to get in. Unfortunately, she was arrested, imprisoned for 6 months, and then she was threatened with more interrogation and more imprisonment, and she became more and more anxious, and she committed suicide. And she committed suicide through setting herself on fire in front of the building of the Iranian Football Federation. And that united the nation against the mullahs and the clergy like nothing else. So that is the power of football. It raises passions, but it also makes people think. It provides a space for people to be together the way they see fit and debate issues. Even football chanting has become politicized, and those political chanting then filter through the wider world.
Yeah, so that was Babak Fizuni there talking to Off the Ball. So are these games going to go ahead, the pool game? I think all three of them are meant to be in the US. Are they have their visas, but I mean, that could get quite nasty depending on who decides to turn up.
Yeah, and I think so there's a huge Iranian population in Los Angeles, so you'd imagine that there'd be quite a big turnout of Iranian Americans to those games. They have to fly on the day of, so in and out, I think within the day of games, and go back to Mexico at the Iranian football team. Interestingly, quite a sideshow. Just like there's all this, and then there's usual World Cup controversy. They're meant to be playing in the Pride match against Egypt in Seattle. Basically, FIFA's sort of, with June being Pride Month, their statement of being supportive of the LGBTQ plus community. This was put down as it was always going to be in Seattle, and it just so happened that Iran and Egypt were the two teams that had played that game. And I can't think of two regimes who would be more vehemently opposed to playing in something called the Pride Match. So
there is kind of a delicious irony there, isn't there? It's like having to wear maybe the Pride flag on the sleeve or something. You could just see how that would rile people up.
Oh, it's brilliant. Like only Logan Roy, I think, or Kendall Roy, more appropriately, could come up with something so egg in the facey.
Yeah, delicious. What about then if people who want to actually go to these games and the ticket prices? Because look, it's America, it's consumerism. Of course it is. It's always expensive to travel to a World Cup, but this time in particular, and I suppose I'm slightly viewing this, whatever figures you're going to tell me, I imagine are going to be dwarfed by the sporting event I've been paying the most attention to over the last few weeks, which is the NBA Finals, where I think tickets for MSG for the Knicks' first home game started at 11 grand. Are we in that territory or close enough to it for some of these games?
Yeah, and it's funny you should say, because certainly in the early days when the ticket prices were announced, the justification from the American side was, this is just what a successful economy looks like. You know, you have to just put up and shut up. But according to The Athletic, when FIFA first put tickets up on sale last October, prices were already the highest in World Cup history. Then over the months that followed, they raised them using basically something they call variable pricing, which is dynamic pricing under a different name. FIFA's Category 1 prices for the 2026 group stage, excluding the openers, range from 390 to 860 euro. In 2022 in Qatar, those same tickets cost around 191 euro. Category 1 tickets for the 2026 quarterfinals cost upwards of 1,180 euro. That's compared with 369 euro in Qatar. Just to give you a sense of what Irish fans would have had to pay if we'd qualified. So we would have played Mexico in the Azteca Stadium in Mexico City on the 24th of June. That place has now been taken by Czechia, and the game is a sellout, but tickets are available on the ticket resale website Viagogo. The cheapest tickets available a couple of weeks ago were 1,045 euro, with the most expensive over 18,000, Sean. The original face value, 192 euro to 507. And the most expensive ticket for the final is priced at around 9,000 euro, with four tickets advertised for more than 1.7 million last month on FIFA's official resale website. So not even a scalper.
Genie, Mac. I think it's kind of put a tone on this, and you were speaking to, I think on this on BBC News, wasn't it? Chris Donahue, not that Chris Donahue that people might know, of the American Outlaws fan group, speaking about those prices.
I think a lot of people within the American Outlaws knew that these prices would be extreme, but I don't think anyone really understood what it would cost to take a 40-hour trip to go see your national team play. You know, category 2-3 tickets are upwards of $2,000, and that's without flight, hotel. I don't see the legality part of it, but I also don't see the moral part of it. I don't know why the goal of FIFA seems to be making money versus getting butts in seats. I think that American fans, this is as good as it gets for seeing your national team play in a World Cup at home. I think this is what fans have dreamt of their whole lives, and now that it's here, it just feels a little bit like it's an elitist type event. And say what you want about the process, I understand that you have to weed people out and not everyone's going to get to go to every game that they want to go to, but it seems to me like the average person that is a hardworking American just can't afford to attend games in their hometowns. And I don't see why this was the goal and it wasn't communicated from the beginning.
So that was Chris Donahue there talking about those pretty extortionate prices. What then, because the one that always sticks in my mind, and I remember listening to Off the Ball before I worked in Newstar, around the time anyway, about the Brazil World Cup. And obviously the big controversies were the favelas and these big stadiums being built that we've now seen go to rack and ruin. America, a very different country, very different economy. Are we seeing much of that, where there's, the local community being done out by the World Cup, and while it's great for all the fans, X place has lost something, power grid, or lost a park or whatever it is?
Yeah, so just on the general kind of carbon footprint of this World Cup, unsurprisingly, it's going to be the biggest ever. So given that this is a World Cup taking place across not just the US, but Canada and Mexico, the amount of air travel required for teams, officials and fans is on a pretty unprecedented scale. You add to this the fact that there's no high-speed rail, there are no buses, so to speak, that you would get in traditional hosting nations in Europe and Asia. And it means that really, air is the only mode of transport that's feasible for anyone trying to get anywhere on time in this World Cup that aren't going at maybe the languid pace of casual fans. It's going to be by far the pollutingest World Cup in history, to use an American phrase. According to the new Weather Institute, total emissions will be approximately 9.02 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, which is almost double the historical average attributable to World Cup finals tournaments. Air transport will make up 7.72 million of that carbon dioxide equivalent ton. It's over four times the size of a typical World Cup finals between South Africa in 2010 and Qatar in 2022. Due to the high number of matches, so there's 104 games this year across the 48 teams and the vast distances between the host cities across those three countries. There's a very specific example of how it's really affecting communities and their access to vital resources. So the Azteca Stadium in Mexico City is owned by a subsidiary of the Mexican media conglomerate Televisa, who will be the national broadcaster of this World Cup in Mexico. That stadium was built in 1962 in time, originally for the 68 Olympics and then used for the 1970 World Cup finals. It was on land expropriated from the people of Santa Úrsula Coapa, who were an indigenous community whose roots in the territory predated the arrival of the Aztecs, and it covers an area of around 65 hectares with a population of 10,800 clustered around this stadium. Televisa began drilling a well into a local aquifer. Now, aquifers in Mexico City are pretty much the entire water source for really impoverished nations, and they're usually subject to rationing, these communities, because the water is so scarce. So Televisa began drilling this well and move water away from the neighborhoods around the stadium to adjacent areas to feed condo towers, commercial developments that are not subject to this rationing. And it means that there are serious water shortages in a way that has been unprecedented or that never came before this World Cup started. So there's testimony here from a CBC News Canada broadcast from locals and how they've been affected.
Maria Estela Alejandro says she had no water yesterday and is only now able to wash the dishes. When there's water, this is the maximum water pressure, she says. Alejandro lives a couple blocks from Azteca Stadium, along an alleyway with 50 other families. They often go days without water. But she says the owners of the stadium, which will be called Mexico City Stadium during the World Cup, have their own well, and they never run out. I think it's ridiculous that a company owns a well, she says. Water is for the people, she says.
We don't have water, and Televisa always has water for the grass, and we don't have water for washing, for do the laundry, or for maybe for cooking, but Televisa always has water.
So that well actually was originally part of a planned, now abandoned development approved in 2021 by Claudia Sheinbaum, who was then the mayor of Mexico City. And the controversy, so they were assured that the well at the stadium is now in the hands of the city, but locals have said that this is not true, that they've received no notification or information about the transfer of the well, and they've been presented with no plans to improve the community's drinking water. So, as I said, as well as the Trump and the Iran and the visa and ticket price nonsense, you've got the usual unfortunate consequences of World Cup hosting, which is that the local communities generally bear the brunt of construction and the consequences of the World Cup moving out of town.
Mm. If we're looking, just to go back to the environmental piece for a minute, like, is there a way, and I know America won't be concerned with it, but is there a way to do a World Cup in an environmentally friendly way? You've got so many fans coming from so many different countries. It's And fair enough, none of them will be as bad as the one that we're seeing now, but it's still very carbon intensive, really, no matter what you do.
Yeah, I suppose they are trying to bring schemes in. I know that I know that Freddie Daly, who is part of Cool Down for Sport for Climate Action and at the University of Sussex, outlined that while the FIFA have made commitments to be more eco-friendly and climate conscious in the way they're running these big tournaments and major tournaments in their day-to-day operations, that a lot of their policies on this matter are quite outdated.
But ultimately and urgently, we need to look at the size of these tournaments, the scale, and also where they're hosted. Can the hosts offer low carbon transport options, public transport? Can the infrastructure be existing and also concentrated? These are very important factors that need to be taken into consideration, and they're difficult decisions because sport is a global game, and it should be able to be hosted and played in other parts of the world. So I'm under no illusions about how difficult this is, but we're in a climate crisis and these considerations need to be taken into account. FIFA has put in place some mechanisms to protect players in particular, so we can see hydration breaks, but it's too little and I would say probably too late. Their heat guidelines haven't been updated for over a decade, and that's the sort of temperatures at which games are cooled off because they become dangerous for both for players. They haven't improved these sort of guidelines. So I think, and I hope I'm wrong, I think there's a very real risk that we will see players under extreme circumstances, and we may see some players fall ill, which will cause disruption to the tournament as well. And of course, when we're talking about heat and extreme heat, we often focus on the players, but the fans in the stands and in the stadiums are also going to be exposed to these temperatures and these levels of humidity. So I think FIFA could have done a lot more to protect players and fans, and should going forward to make sure that future tournaments are more resilient in the face of changes that we know are going to happen because of our emissions.
That's Freddie Daly of Cool Down Sport for Climate Action. So Cameron, and look, we're in the early days of it, and there is still every bit the chance that we all get swept up in the football and it becomes amazing and much watched TV, and that's what people remember. But in the 21st century, and particularly the part of the 21st century that we're living in now, when so much, look at Eurovision, you know, utterly unmissed, I would say, by the Irish public this year after taking a principled stand not to broadcast it or participate. Do you think the political game around it and what the Trump and the MAGA movement will make it just by being hosts is going to sour it for a lot of people? Or really, when the going's good, the sport is good, and that's all you remember?
It's a really interesting case study in how they approach this vis-a-vis the Olympics coming to town in Los Angeles in 2028. I suppose like that'll be a real test and will be probably hopefully the crown and glory for Trump of his presidency, that he has the Olympics, because like, to be honest and to use rather blue language, Sean, they're sports that Americans actually give a shit about, whereas soccer is one of those kind of things they never quite kind of got to grips, even though I think they were like third place at the first ever World Cup back in 1930. So they've history in the game. But I suppose what's so interesting about how the Americans, especially, because like we forget that Canada and Mexico are hosting this because of how much Trump and the American side of things have dominated the landscape. It's that they don't care. Like every other regime up to this point, you mentioned the two Petro states previously who had hosted World Cups. At least then there was a little bit of, and I mean, at least then, there was a little bit of trying to hide the things behind the scenes and go, no, we are a much more welcoming nation than is being presented. Qatar, especially trying to enhance its international reputation by hosting the World Cup firstly, and then giving everybody a good time. Like Americans don't care. The organisers really don't care. And that's why the fan testimony and how they experience this World Cup is going to be so interesting to track, because there are fans who can't get into the country because their visa applications didn't come through. I think the South African assistant coach can't go to the World Cup because his visa didn't come through in time. Mm. And you imagine that there will be stories, at least online, maybe not as much through official channels until we get them, of fans from various parts of the world, because so many all come in, like the prevalence of ice, what's that going to do to fans? How safe are they going to feel? There feels like there's going to be a controversy or two there. And on top of which, it's just this, as you say, this American arrogance and exceptionalism of, this is just how we do things, and you're going to have to either piss or get off the potty, because this is how we roll. You're in our country now. We don't feel we have to put on a show of, you know, general good behavior. We're putting on a show regardless. And that's why I think this one is slightly different and probably will have a longer legacy than Russia and Qatar in the last two.
Yeah, it's not sports washing if you never need to take a bath. Cameron Hill of Off the Ball, listen, thanks so much. And you guys obviously are going to be keeping everybody up to date on all the action in the World Cup. But thanks so many for joining us on Let Me Explain and for running through, I mean, some of the big controversies around this World Cup. And there's plenty of them. Thank you as well for listening. Appreciate it. Wherever it is you listen to your podcast, don't forget to like and share and all that good stuff, and follow Cameron on social media for more as well. That's it for this week's episode. I will chat to you next week.